Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Casey Stallings, president of Desert Royalty, who came back onto the podcast to walk through buying in the Permian over the last 3 years, the construction of their Fund 7, and their recent raise of $125 million for Fund 8. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what KC had to say.
KC, good morning. It's been about 3 years. Lots changed, not only for Desert, but clearly in the oil patch, the mineral space, right? When we were on, I think I saw on LinkedIn a couple of days ago, the anniversary of negative $37 oil. So we've had some ups and downs for sure. And I'm looking forward to going on that roller coaster ride in retrospect with you here throughout the episode. But before doing that, a little refresher for those who don't know, can you just give a high level overview on Desert Royalty and y'all's legacy and the kind of high level bullet points, and then we'll jump into the last 3 years?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Tim, for having me on. Yeah, a lot has changed since last time we were talking on the podcast. So glad to we are where we are, given where we talked last time. But yeah, so Desert Royalty Company is a long-term mineral company. It was founded by my dad, Kyle Stallings, and his partner, Buddy Gibb, in 1990, where they were buying royalties, using tax rolls. That's really all they focused on, was buying PDP, but also non-producing properties using bank debt. And they would sell down some and keep as much as they could. And for the last 22 years, we have been raising funds. And we just now raised our most recent funds, Desert Partners 8. And we use those vehicles to buy mineral interest and for the long-term hold. Very selectively and opportunistically, we may do a sale from time to time. But for the most part, we keep everything that we have for a long-term hold. As of today, we own 90% of everything that we've purchased over the last 22 years.
Fantastic. And so you've done kind of raised and deployed 7 funds, and you just raised the 8th fund, correct?
That's right.
Where do you guys own? What does the portfolio look like today? Just kind of high-level bullet points, you know, basins, states, NRAs, et cetera.
Sure. So the family of funds collectively have about 165,000 net royalty acres, with the highlight being in the Permian Basin. We have about 43,000 acres today in the Permian Basin, with the majority of that being in the Delaware. We have about 33,000 and change in the Delaware and about 10,000 in the Midland. And so the number of dollars deployed over the last 22 years is $520 million that we've deployed. Desert Partners 7 was initially a $60 million fund that grew to be a $125 million fund. And we just raised our 8th fund, being an initial raise of $125 million, and that may grow over time. But that's kind of where we are. Most of the revenue does come out of the Permian, but we have strong positions in the Bakken and in the Haynesville and East Texas Eagle Ford, as well as the Rockies and Oklahoma. But as far as revenue goes, it would primarily be Permian Basin, Bakken, and then Haynesville.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, appreciate the background there, getting everyone caught up to speed. Let's jump in now. So May 2020 is when you last came on the podcast. At that time, kind of the notable thing for Desert pre-COVID was the partnership with Kimmeridge Energy and the formation of Desert Peak Minerals, which, it's funny to look back, seems like forever ago. But break that down a little bit, what that partnership was and what ended up happening. The end result is now Sitio Royalties, right? And it wasn't a direct linear path. There was quite a few things that happened in between. But from the Desert side, why don't you kind of break down that partnership and how everything played out?
Sure. Yeah. No, those, you know, credit to the Sitio team and everyone involved with that, because they had to react nimbly to a bunch of changes in the market, and they did it successfully. And we were a small piece of what they ended up doing and the success that they had. But ultimately, when Kimmeridge approached us, the idea was that we had an asset similar in size and cash flow, all in the Delaware, that to theirs. And the idea was we could combine these and we would have enough scale to potentially IPO, which, you know, the attraction to us was if we could IPO at a price per acre that we felt like was better than anywhere else that we could get on the private side. And then we would allow our individual investors to make the choice of whether or not they wanted to sell their shares or continue the long-term objective that they signed up with by keeping their shares. It seemed to be a good outcome for our LPs. In a unique time in the mineral space to where we felt like the public markets were valuing the assets on a metric that made sense for us to be sellers at. They were giving a lot of value to the cash flow that resulted in really true value and sometimes even overvalue on the locations and potential of the asset. So we felt like it made sense for us to pursue that. We knew it was going to be a lot of work and time on our team to be able to get our asset to a level that could potentially be in the public markets as far as the administrative and accounting component goes. And so we wanted something to show for this, to put up all this effort. And so we agreed to sell 25% of what we owned at the time in the Delaware Basin for cash. And that was about a $185 million acquisition. We sold about 7,000 acres at that time. And we had agreed the remaining 3/4 of our Delaware asset would be tied to their asset in the Delaware for a period of time. Now, we had restrictions on what the minimum offering price needed to be in a potential IPO. And unfortunately, by the time we were ready to go, the market, COVID had happened, the market was turning, and those thresholds weren't able to be met. We still were interested to try to do something with Kimmeridge. So we did extend those timelines, and we continued to buy alongside them, and they bought alongside us to keep our asset the same all the way through. I guess we went through the summer of 2020 before we just both realized like we're just too far off base for this to meet each other's objectives. So we came up with a game plan to just to unwind the companies, which was actually really simple because we had set it up to look for a potential exit ramp as being an option. And so by the end of 2020, we had formally separated from continuing to buy deals together, continued to talk a lot. And so at that point, we were not involved in anything that Kimmeridge did moving forward. They bought some great companies and continued to grow. But as far as the result with us and Kimmeridge, they bought 25% of our asset for cash in the Delaware Basin in 2019. And that's really what happened. And that's the easiest way to understand it. And no formal connection now, other than we like those guys and talk with them. And I'm sure we'll do deals in the future.
No, thanks for clarifying that. You know, I think it's an interesting perspective and strategy that y'all had originally, because you guys are a long-term hold vehicle, but you see opportunistically in the market, it's a good time to get some liquidity at a great value for your investors, but you're giving them the option to stay in given the liquidity of a public equity or monetize. And it's not kind of a tag along type scenario where they have to sell and may not want to. I think it's an interesting discussion just at a broader level with all publics in, you know, certain vehicles, Dorchester, Kimball, et cetera, have different tax benefits, but all these folks need scale. And so if you're not necessarily looking to exit today and have that big capital gain exposure, do you contribute into these vehicles at the right time, get the good mark to market valuation, and then have optionality to exit or, you know, now in the future, cost average out, et cetera? I think there's a real discussion we had there. And I think that's a role that publics play going forward versus just private equity takeouts, right? To get that scale.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Okay. So now we're in 2020. Let's talk about buying in the Permian throughout 2020. And that's a loaded question. So we're going to break it down in a number of ways. Let's start, I guess, first bullet point I have, Biden comes into the presidency. There's the drilling moratorium in New Mexico. I'm not sure how much your Delaware portfolio is New Mexico versus Texas. Irregardless, it affected competition in Texas because a lot of folks put a big red X on New Mexico in that time period. Gary, COVID, oil goes negative. Oh my God. And with politics, there's always more emotion than really what plays out typically. But oh my God, the government is going to ban oil and gas in New Mexico. There's going to be no more drilling. Like, this is the end of days, right? There was all sorts of crazy dynamics at play. In regards to that moratorium and the trickle-down effects, from y'all's perspective, what are your comments?
Yeah. So, you know, for us, we don't have a large focus on New Mexico. And so we didn't see the direct impact because we weren't actively buying in New Mexico. We love the rock up there, but it did change the way that we were even thinking about opportunities in New Mexico, thinking about there was real political risk. But what ended up happening ended up being kind of interesting because the result of that, of the Biden administration, was we saw a ton of New Mexico permits get filed. Everybody was trying to get the permits filed while they still could. And so in some ways, it kind of helped us understand what not to buy in New Mexico, because if it didn't have sticks on it, we knew it was a long ways out because everybody was putting sticks on it. Now, it was hard to know how important those permits were, because were they just filed to get out there and hopefully get grandfathered in, or are they really planning on drilling those wells? So our main takeaway was we didn't want to buy anything that didn't have permits on it already, or if we did, it had to be at a price that we knew drilling was 5 years out or longer. But again, the focus was on Texas. There may have been competition that shifted from New Mexico to Texas during that time, but there just wasn't a lot of transactions through 2020. You know, we had, before COVID, I think we closed our last deal in February or maybe it was March, and we just didn't buy another deal all through the summer. I mean, it was hard to know what to, you know, run your strip pricing on. And we went dormant for 4 or 5 months probably before we bought our first deal post-COVID or during COVID really in Reagan County. And I remember we were running $40 oil and we felt like it was a scary buy at that price. I think the price per acre was like $2,300 a net royalty acre, and it felt expensive.
Good luck getting $2,300 in NRA now, huh?
Right, exactly. But then we did start picking up some momentum towards the end of 2020. We were fortunate to be able to participate with Kimmeridge on the override that they carved out of the Callon working interest, about $25 million of that deal. And so we closed our sixth fund at the time with that deal, and then also used some of that deal to launch our seventh fund that we raised in November of 2020. But, you know, wish we would have bought more during that time, but we're lucky for everything that we did buy. And so, you know, it's interesting. There may have been more competition on the Texas side, like you said, but I really didn't feel it, because I guess we were kind of on the sidelines waiting to see what would happen. So we weren't really losing deals because we weren't really trying to buy any at the time. We were trying to put together a plan on what the new world looks like.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagle Ford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. As a leading global energy business advisory firm, Opportune is well positioned to provide world-class technical, financial, and operational capabilities to minerals and royalties companies. Whether it's back office outsourcing, resource and reserve definition, land due diligence and administration, GIS mapping, valuation work, data and system integration, financial reporting, tax advisory, or buy and sell side assistance, Opportune LLP has got you covered. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Noble Royalties has been a leader in the minerals and royalty space since 1997. Noble's experience and world-class technical team will assist in delivering effective solutions to EMPs, mineral funds, and private owners alike to maximize the value of their mineral ownership in this dynamic market. To discuss effective mineral solutions, whether buying or selling, in the Permian, Haynesville, Eagle Ford, or Bakken, please reach out to Chase Morris at cmorris@nobleroyalties.com or Shannon Manor at smanor@nobleroyalties.com. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests, or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
You know, it's kind of interesting if you look at the competitive horizon at that time versus today, right? You know, there's less deals just because of the bid-ask spread. Deal flow dries up. There's less brokers that are active. You know, I think Desert's really the exception. You guys have such incredible relationships and such a track record that you're able to raise money much quicker than most and during ups and down cycles. You know, in 2020, what I'm trying to get to is in 2020, if you start to run out of dry powder, you weren't really able to raise the money again, a lot of typical funds. So now traditional M buyers, they're slowing down. Maybe they're flipping stuff in between just to survive. So when all is said and done, I mean, it would be interesting to have a side-by-side comparison of deals available in the market, available dollars, brokers, and how that all fits together. And I guarantee it's never really super easy or super hard. And just the dynamics and the opportunity set changes on how you can put that money to work, which goes to my next question of, you know, you mentioned you did the override deal with Callan with Kimmeridge, which is interesting. I think you guys are a pretty dynamic group. You know, most will be ground game only, right? That's what they do. They pound the pavement. They're buying stuff wholesale. You know, if they do that, maybe it's, we love deals that are 200 grand to 3 million. Or no, we raise a big slug of capital and we're only looking for elephant deals, or we only buy from brokers. Just most folks pick their lane. You guys are very, very dynamic and have done all sorts of different deals. I would argue have tremendous relationships just given how long you've been in the space, and that enables you to do stuff at the wholesale level, but you've done larger deals. Participating in a reversionary structure is interesting. Yeah, I'd look back at 2020, you had the Antero override with Sixth Street up in Appalachia, this override here in the Permian, which is the only override I believe has happened with that kind of structure in the Permian. It's harder to carve an override out just given how skinny the NRI is. But that type of financial engineering was what was needed to, you know, get the bid-ask spread narrowed. And I think in any going forward, what I learned is anytime we have some severe price volatility, you're going to see that kind of structure, reversionary override type deal come back into favor. Gas right now, I think you'll probably see a few of those happening in the next year, because it's the only way to get the deals done, because just straight standard deal terms, the buyer and the seller are going to be too far apart. But yeah, overall, when you look at the opportunity set, ground game, you know, secondary market from consolidators, large deals, creative structuring, what was 2020 in your mind? What were the best opportunities?
Yeah, I think the best opportunities were the ones that, well, first you had to have an end user that was willing to take a stance on what they think is going to happen. And we were able to get to a place to where we felt like we had enough confidence to predict what the next 2 to 5 years look like in long term, what things look like, and started being able to buy. And so I think that's what it started with, was like having some capital and having some confidence behind it. And in the deals that we saw that we were buying were ground game deals. That was for the most part, with the exception of the override from Callan. Everything else was ground game that we have relationships with, people that we have been talking with. There's always a Rolodex of people that are, you know, that would sell at the right price. And so we went back and talked to some of these people and said, you know, I think we're ready. I think we're good to make a real offer. And we started getting momentum on the ground. So we really didn't make any large acquisitions through 2020, with the exception of the Callan override that really Kimmeridge created for us, which was extremely unique. That one was actually a perpetual carve out. And I think they were able to get that because of their unique structuring with the secondary note that they were able to provide to Callan. And I think that overall it was a win-win. I think Callan got the juice they needed to move forward and become stronger. And it was there was buyers for that that override and that secondary note. So I think everyone benefited from that.
And then so you guys found most success on the ground game. Talk to me about the broker network. In 2020, I remember it shrunk significantly. If it's fair to say the bad actors were squeezed out, guys who don't represent real money, who are just tying up deals at unrealistic pricing and then backing out the 11th hour, that just complicates things for real shops like Desert, because now you have to justify what an actual real market price is versus these phantom numbers that are out there. So just by, you know, survival of the fittest, the ones that were still brokering deals and buying on behalf of groups were the good shops. Did you find that ground pricing got a little more efficient, or was more true to market in that time frame, or it's just hard because it was such a weird time that deals were still super hard to shake loose?
Yeah, I think that the ground game, or the in-between broker kind of went away during that time. I mean, I think that if I had a broker come to me in 2020 and say, hey, I've got line of sight to this deal, I think we could get it for this price. I mean, I would just be hearing noise because, of course, I mean, you're looking for a buyer. There's people willing to sell the asset. And I didn't really need help finding that like I did in 2018 and 2019. And so I don't think that we did very many broker deals in 2020. I didn't feel like we really needed to. Now, we needed those guys in 2018 and 2019. And, you know, if they had a real buyer, a live one on the line, then that was value that we wanted to investigate. And some of them turn out differently than others as far as what is you're really buying. And we kind of learned through osmosis who the bad actors are. And we give priority to the ones we've done deals with. But you see that coming back a little bit now. I think that the market is so tight that it's on a much more restrained level. I think that the margins are really, really thin to get anything done. But I think it's out there. I think it's like a reasonable margin, but there's no more buying, you know, getting someone signed up at $10,000 an acre and flipping it to someone for $18,000. I think those days are forever gone in the Permian.
Okay, great. Yeah, no, that was my follow-up question was, okay, 2021, 2022, is it here we go again? There's just a bunch of noise, but it's somewhere in between. You said the market really is more efficient forever going forward, and you have to be doing business the right way to be able to survive.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons for that is I feel like generally the market has just gotten more mature to where the owners of these assets are, you're less and less getting uneducated people that have the ownership and they're just trying to sell it as fast as they can. They're happy that they inherited something and now they just want to liquidize it. So I think what we're seeing is that you're dealing with someone who is going to get about what it's worth one way or the other. And it may take longer. It may be frustrating, but like there's enough tools and resources out there that they're going to get what the asset is worth.
Okay, great. So we get through 2020. You already mentioned this. You did the $25 million allocation to the Callon override, which closed out your Fund 6 and started with the launch of Fund 7 in December of 2020. So that originally started at $60 million. It grew to $125, I think you said. Why don't you walk through, you just closed out Fund 7 with another large acquisition. It seems to be a theme of y'all. So you like to close out your funds with a big deal in November of 2022. So over the last few years, what did you guys build in Fund 7? What was the kind of the NRA count, the basin exposure? And then we'll break it down on how you did it.
Sure. So 20, our Desert Partner 7, like you said, launched in December of 2020. We closed it in November of 2022. So just a hair less than 2 years. In that time, we purchased about 12,500 acres, most of that being in the Permian. So 7,200 of it was in the Delaware, and then another 3,700 of it, 3,800 was in the Midland Basin. And so that was the concentration where most of the dollars went. Then there were some opportunistic buys that we made in the Eagle Ford and the Haynesville, but they make up a small piece of really what Desert Partners 7 is. And that seventh fund benefited from commodity price. We were fortunate to buy quite a bit in the Callon override to launch. And then 2021, we bought a lot of minerals just on the ground, broker deals. And those deals were bought at low commodity price and have benefited from what's happened since. So yeah, the last 2 years has been, or for that fund, has been a Permian focused fund that ultimately bought about 12,000 acres.
What would you say was the major difference from a deal flow or in a transaction perspective of oil running up over $100 over these last few years?
You know, how we reacted to that is we had several deals in the pipeline where we knew they had a certain number that they wanted. And I'm thinking of three grassroots deals that we had specific numbers from sellers that said, if I could ever get X price per acre or this many million dollars, I'm a seller. And when the price ran up, we went back to those people and said, hey, I think we can do that now. And to their credit, they said, okay, that's what we wanted. We get it. The price of oil went up. That justifies it. And we were able to get over $20 million of deals in a short amount of time, probably from February to call it April, where we went back to relationships that we knew they had certain numbers that they wanted to hit. And the spike in prices allowed us to get the confidence to get there. Now, we were only able to do that with properties that had existing cash flow because it didn't really move the strip that much when the price of oil spiked in February. And so the long-term deals with lots of locations to be drilled, we couldn't necessarily pay a material amount more for those. But the ones that had cash flow that we could model a totally different return for the next 6 months, that was enough to push us to get some deals bought.
Yeah, no, on that point, I think when on the other side, when prices crash, it's really hard to buy those developed deals, but you can still transact on those white space PUD deals because, to your point, the strip, especially 48 months, 36, yeah, 48 months, doesn't materially change. And you're looking at gas. I just closed a small Haynesville deal that was a white space deal about a month ago. And gas was just plummeting. And when I first signed up the mandate, it was $9. Cool. And by the time we got the back and forth and everything, we go out to market, it's three, then it's 250, it's two. But I showed the seller, listen, really in an ideal scenario, you want to go back to up to $5-6, but the 48 month strip, which is when a lot of these wells are going to get drilled and beyond, is only down 10%. So let's do the math. This isn't a huge deal. Are you willing to wait? Your family made a decision to sell this. Are you willing to wait? And maybe you get an extra 5% to the asking price. And that's if things boomerang back up to $6, which is, going to be very difficult because that's a real bull gas market. So yeah, I think when price runs up, great opportunity to buy PDP. When price falls off a cliff, the reversionary structures, the white space deals become more transactable. And that's a really good point that you bring up. If you're building a relationship with a family over a 2, 3, 4, 5 plus year period, and they say, we want this number, and then commodity price environment enables you to lean in on that, and that's when you can transact. That's a great comment, a great perspective. Because I always hear these stories of, oh, we've been talking to this family for 5 years, and I just wonder what the trigger is. Is it could be a wedding or, health-related issues or something, but I didn't think about it from the buying perspective. And if you're just transparent, you're saying, hey, we're a professional shop, we have to use engineering and strip and everything, and now we're able to lean in and they don't move the field goal post on you, then yeah, that's great, right? And they, like you said, they hold to their word and you can get deals done.
Yes. Yeah. My expectation, honestly, was that, well, now the new price is this because we're at $100 oil. But no, in these examples, these families knew what they wanted and they set that and they didn't move it. So they got what they wanted and we're glad we transacted.
Fantastic. Now, I mentioned this briefly. Let's dive in a little deeper. You guys actually press released this deal in mid-November of 2022. Pretty large transaction, 2,905 NRAs, mostly Reeves and Loving. Whatever you're able to share, was this from a professional shop? Was it an aggregate portfolio? Was it from a landowner? Well, over to you.
Yeah, so this was a large landowner, land and mineral owner, and very sophisticated person who had his own in-house land man that he had on retainer, understood his asset very, very well, very, very intelligent family. And they wanted to do something strategic with their asset. And they knew the value of it. It was cash flowing, or is cash flowing tremendously, compared to where it was several years prior. And they knew it was a good time to transact. The unique thing on this transaction is the family's view on the properties where this is a great long-term property to own. They understood that, which is why it was so difficult for them to sell. But there were some good reasons and they had good opportunities to do something with the property. And the attraction, I think, to them and to us was we discussed merging their asset in with our seventh mineral fund, which allowed them to diversify beyond just these really, really dense tracts, in specific areas in Reeves and Loving, and be able to spread that across the 12,000 acres we had in the fund. And so it was largely an equity deal. I think it was 90% was ownership in Desert Partner 7, and then 10% was just cash up front. And then part of what we did as a result was we agreed to close the fund after that transaction. So that way the family knew exactly what they were going to own. They knew what percentage of every tract that they would own in through the form of an LP. And, they had good expectations of what the cash flow would look like post-merger. And it was a good fit for them. It was a, you know, it, the 90% was a tax deferred event. So there wasn't a large tax consequence for them this year. You know, that'll be down the road if and when we ever sell. But as far as, you know, their 2022 tax affairs are relatively simple, just because there's, you know, 90% of that was not a taxable event. And, you know, I think it was a really good deal for us and a really good deal for the family, because we, their asset was gassier than ours. And we paid for that in the form of equity. But, you know, it kind of balances out when oil goes up and gas goes down. You know, he gets the benefit of that as well. So both parties are really happy with the transaction. And it was a, it was just the right fit. That doesn't always happen. The stars kind of have to align on something like that, to where you actually have someone who is ultimately looking to make a mineral investment, and they want to use their properties as a way of doing that. And we've done that, I guess, three other times over the years. And every time we've done it, it's been a great outcome for both parties.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Noble Royalties has been a leader in the minerals and royalty space since 1997. Noble's experience and world-class technical team will assist in delivering effective solutions to EMPs, mineral funds, and private owners alike to maximize the value of their mineral ownership in this dynamic market. To discuss effective mineral solutions, whether buying or selling, in the Permian, Haynesville, Eagleford, or Bakken, please reach out to Chase Morris at cmorris@nobleroyalties.com or Shannon Manor at smanor@nobleroyalties.com. Need energy industry management experience at your fingertips? Opportune LLP, a leading global energy business advisory firm, has the capabilities needed to overcome your minerals and royalties team's technical, operational, and financial challenges. To learn more, search Opportune's podcast E2B Energy to Business on Apple and Spotify Podcasts, where Opportune examines emerging financial and technology trends and provides a broad perspective on ways to stay ahead, create opportunities, and execute market strategies. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Now, listen, kudos to the creativity. It just bolsters my earlier point of how dynamic you guys can be. I mean, you look at, you're buying ground game, you're buying, you know, mid-market, you did an override deal, you did a basically an equity merge with a strategic family. I mean, it just goes to show, to create value for investors long-term, you need to be willing to do things differently and create value opportunistically. And I think you guys are doing that at Desert. And that's just another example. So very, very cool. And, you know, it's interesting, almost not the same, but just a little cash off the table. Same thing you guys did with Cambridge, right? And then there's a strategic long-term play, exposure to a broader portfolio. It's kind of like the private index or ETF approach. So this family, instead of having all their eggs in one basket, they're getting commodity diversification and also asset diversification, which is very, very cool.
Well, and also their life got a lot simpler. You know, instead of getting 22 checks a month and having to deal with all these operators and, you know, easements and right-of-ways, now they get one check a month from Desert Partner 7 and they get one K-1 at the end of the year. And so I think the quality of life that they have is also improved.
Yeah, no, for sure. I want to touch on this before we get into Fund 8. You mentioned that this family had a lot of gas exposure. Gas has gone from $2 to $9 down to $2. There's a lot of gas in the Western Delaware. I know in conversations with you offline in the past, just talking about transactions, you guys have a decent amount of gas exposure. How do you view gas in the Western Delaware right now? I guess kind of short, mid and long term.
That's a tough one because specific to the Western Delaware, because of the infrastructure and takeaway issues, we're seeing real deducts that matter. And you couple that with, you know, with a strip that's on the rise, it's hard to feel like that's the right way to buy this gas, is you just are expecting a rising gas price and, you know, ultimately the deducts to go away. Because, I mean, that those things will happen, but when is it going to happen is what's hard to model. And so the way we do it is we build in whatever current deducts we're seeing, and we just have to keep those in because we don't know when they're going to go away. And also we have to think realistically about what is the price of gas going to be. And, you know, the strip would indicate it's going back to six in the next 48 months or so. And we think it may take longer. There's, you know, we've seen what happens when the price goes up to six. It doesn't stay there very long. But there is we have a tremendous amount of gas in this country, and we will find ways to use it. And I think that it's the demand side that needs to change for there to be a sustainably higher price of gas. So it's a tough thing for us to buy Western Delaware gas. It's a lot easier to buy the dry gas in the most profitable gas field in America, you know, the Marcellus and the Haynesville. We feel more confident on those types of exposure to gas.
Well, great. Well, so again, congrats. You close out Fund 7 late last year, and then you go right into raising Fund 8, which, I mean, well done. Less than 6 months, you guys raised $125 million. It's phenomenal. You know, your investors have been high net worth and family offices through and through. This is a unique time for these types of investors, you know, high net worth and family offices. It's an inflationary environment. There's a recession around the corner. You know, the public, you know, the stock market is challenged. You got SVB and all sorts of complications on the banking side. When you go out and you're raising this fund, what are the things you hear the most from your investors in regards to investing into minerals, investing with Desert, et cetera?
You know, I think that the timing of raising this fund was really helpful to raise the money quickly, because we didn't actually launch a funding effort until early March of this year. And by the middle of April, we had $125 million of commitments that we could have had more had we not cut it off. And it really spoke to these investors, that might be the high net worth families. There's not a lot of confidence to put it into the stock market right now. They love the natural hedge on inflation by having a real asset and putting it into the ground. I think they like our patient approach, to where we don't feel the pressure to put a bunch of capital to work right now, even though we have it on standby. We'll be patient and we'll wait for the right deals. And I think that resonated a lot with these families. The other thing unique to this fund that we haven't done in other funds is, and it's too complicated really to go into the details on a podcast, but there's mechanisms in the fund that allow us to tailor our structure unique to the exact asset that we're looking to buy. You know, different structures tailor better for long-term hold deals than, you know, deals that are getting, you know, have 18 ducks on them. And so there's some mechanisms we have to change the way that we're looking at each asset and the way that the LPs benefit, to where we can have closer to an optimal structure for each individual property that we're trying to acquire. And so I think that spoke as well to the investors, to have the dynamics to look at each deal kind of as a standalone. Like, if we were going to buy this and they for only this purpose, how would we buy it? And so I think that's going to open up the opportunities to us in this next fund. Historically, we have been not the best buyer of, you know, really large PDP deals or marketed deals. But in this new fund, I think we've removed some hurdles to where that will be something that we'll be looking at, where previously we really shouldn't have been the buyer of those assets.
And then put another way, you guys have essentially created different buckets of different costs of capital. So you have ultimate versatility on taking down the right asset at the right time. And then you just go internally, you huddle internally with your investors and say, this is the kind of return we're going to get in a deal like this, but it's a great opportunity. And everyone stacks hands and says, move forward, essentially, right?
Yeah, our main objective is to deliver great yield to the LPs. And if we can do that consistently, then we think that we'll be fine on the GP side. And so even though there's, you know, different structures benefit the GP in different ways, our primary objective is just to deliver the best deal we possibly can to our LPs. And we think the GP will take care of itself. But another reason we care so much about the LPs is we are one of the largest LPs in our own fund. I think we're the third largest LP as a company collectively. And so this is our avenue to good mineral deals is our LP exposure. And so we are aligned on that aspect.
Very, very cool. Is it Permian again? What's the focus here on this fund, or is it to be determined and opportunistic?
No, there's going to be a focus on the Permian. It's just pretty natural for us to continue using our network and relationships and also use our existing asset in the Permian as a kind of a barometer of where opportunity is. So I suspect it will be largely Permian. I think it will be closer to a 50-50 Midland-Delaware split is my guess. But we also would like exposure to gas in East Texas or Louisiana. I could see that being a component of the fund. But probably more opportunistically, most of the ground game will be focused on the Permian, I'm sure.
And you know, when you look at the Permian, if you were to do a time lapse over the last decade, the map is getting more and more Christmas lights on it. White space is shrinking, right? Essentially.
Yes.
Where do you see the opportunities going forward? I mean, with interest rates as high as they are, groups that buy with bank debt may be a little bit, you know, squeeze a little bit more. And there could be some interesting opportunities in the secondary market for all cash buyers like yourselves. That's just one thing I see, whether it be gas, you know, a little bit more of a distressed environment like Haynesville buyers who bought last year, or just in general, 9%, 10% debt is expensive for minerals, right? So
yes,
the leash is shorter. But where do you guys see opportunities going forward?
You know, that's a useful observation that we have as well, is that the white space in the Permian is shrinking and it's going away. And we think that, you know, we can't continue to produce more oil than we did the year before forever. And as we're seeing these white spaces disappear, we think that we're getting closer and closer to the Permian start to decline in their daily volumes, which will have tremendous impact on the supply side of oil globally. But in the meantime, we put tremendous value on those white spaces that have been undisturbed. You know, we have 10 years of learning and technology improvements from when we first started coming into the Wolfcamp and drilling horizontally. And so these remaining untouched version 1280s are just, they hold a tremendous amount of value. Now, you're going to pay for that value. Even though there's no line of sight to drilling, it's HBP'd. It's, you know, there's no obligation to drill new wells. Everybody knows that it's going to get drilled in the next 3 to 5 years, because where else are you going to drill? It's economically motivated to the operator to do so. And so you're not taking as much risk when you're buying these HBP white space deals, because there's not as many up and left. And that's reflected in the price. And even if you are a private equity backed sponsor group that has a 8% pref, I mean, it's less and less scary to buy those deals than it was 3 or 4 years ago. So we're seeing more competition on those for sure. And one of the reasons we wanted to have an adaptable structure was to remain as competitive as we can as we see this market change over the next 2 to 3 years.
No, absolutely. Do you see the tier one boundaries being pushed out a bit with technology? Are the lines chalk that can be erased, or are they permanent marker?
Yeah, I would say in the Midland, we've seen the tier one kind of grow a little bit for sure. And maybe more specifically, we've seen tier three become solid tier two. I think that the boundaries north and east have been pushed in a positive way over the last 2 to 3 years. And we've seen areas that previously were thought risky and, you know, four wells a section type area become, you know, definitively 16 wells a section. And so I think we're seeing more tier three develop into tier two than more tier one come on the market. But also the tier two acreage is starting to be able to justify more tier one type assumptions, whereas, you know, because there's just less of it altogether. And a lot of operators have tier two left. And if an operator is focused on the area, you can pay a lot more. So it is changing. It's always changing. But I do think that largely we understand where the meat of the Permian is. And you can't change that a whole lot from here, I don't think.
Phenomenal. Well, Casey, been a pleasure having you back on. Thanks for sharing everything and going into the weeds. Congrats to you and the team on continued success and the new fun going forward. For everyone listening here, I mean, you guys have cash, you want to do deals. What are the best ways to get a deal done with you guys? Are there certain things your team are looking for, certain ways to bring a deal to you? I think the key is, right, if you're someone who's feeding deals to larger buyers like Desert, if you can get a couple over the line, then there starts to build trust and you start getting bumped up to the top of the pipeline. But for those who may not be in that position who have done stuff with you in the past, what are ways to say, okay, this is less brain damage, let's go take a run at this and try to get something done? You know, what are the pet peeves? Let's just try to help everyone involved here, you guys and the listeners, to get more transactions done with you guys.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I can say, just looking at who we do deals with, especially groups that are looking to either get a carry or just make the spread on the deal, about the only way that that works, at least at our shop, is if we can just be completely transparent. The best ways is if you have a deal and you don't have it signed up, call me and tell me, like, hey, I think I can get this guy. He's not signed up yet, but if I get him signed up, would you guys be interested? And we can talk about what that would look like. The best deals are when we get an email that or a call that says, look, I have this under contract. I've attached it as the PDF shows that we've got a contract in place. I've redacted some pertinent information, but I've got a deal here. I'm looking to get this price. And those go to the top of the list, and we run that through our economics and geology as quick as we can, because that's a live one that we want to focus on. And you just, the ones that do that, there's just that many that can, but the ones that do, we try to prioritize and reward and try to work towards an ongoing formal relationship with.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'll use that as a closing off comment here for the episode. Thanks again for coming on, Casey. And I look forward to seeing you again, either in Midland or Houston, wherever it may be, in person. And when the summer gets here, and enjoy it with you and the family.
All right. Well, thanks, Tim. I appreciate everything you're doing for the industry, and great to be back. So thanks again.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.